is Monday, September 17th, and this is the hearing of the Alaska Joint Armed Services Committee. I am Bill Wilkowski, the co-chair. I'm joined by co-chair Representative Sadler. We have with us today General Case, Representative Peterson, Representative Lynn, Representative Feige, General Lestenkoff, Colonel Jones, and General Canellis. And I want to thank you all for attending. This is an important committee hearing. We are obviously concerned about the potential impacts of a base realignment and closure round that may be coming. The legislature, as you all know, appropriated funding to hire a consultant. We're joined by Senator Davis as well. Oh, and I should mention we have Senator Thomas and Senator Passan online in Fairbanks at the LAO. And we also have Chick Wallace online as well. And legislature appropriated $300,000 to hire a consultant. We hired Hijack and Fix, a consulting group, to develop Alaska strategies to protect our bases. Since our last meeting, the consulting group has had an opportunity to take a number of meetings around the state, and they will be updating the committee on the developments. First off, we're going to hear from Major General Thomas Katkus, the Adjutant General Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and then we'll hear from Hijack and Fix via teleconference, who will then discuss recent developments and their findings from their travels around the state. So let's get started with General Katkus, and joined by his deputy committee. We are also joined by Senator Coghill online as well. Welcome, Senator Coghill. Okay, General, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your presentation.
Good morning, sir. Tom Katkus. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and also the Adjutant General for the State of Alaska. Sir, good morning. We're here for, as you said, a very important meeting we've been working on for quite some time. And we do have, I believe, the consultant on the line, Steve Hijack, and I'd like to defer directly over to him for an update if we do have him online.
Steve, are you there?
Hello.
Okay. Mr. Hijack, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record. And I think we have some members here who weren't with us at our last meeting, so if you could perhaps just give us a brief overview of your background and how you got involved in this project, and then go right into the report.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, we can hear you great.
Okay,
and
okay.
We may have questions throughout, so I know you were very good. It's sometimes challenging when we're doing telephonic presentations, but if there are questions, I'll just interrupt you, and if you could just pause every now and then, and we'll see if there are questions, okay?
Very good, sir. Be happy to do so. Sir, by virtue of introduction for those with whom I did not have the pleasure of meeting earlier this year, again, my name is Steve Hijack. I'm a partner in Hijack and Fix. We're a consulting firm here in Washington, D.C. As a brief background, I worked for 7 years on Capitol Hill for Senator Robert Stafford from Vermont. Following that time, I worked for the Secretary of the Army, 1981 to 1986, in legislative affairs. During that period of time was when I first became engaged working on installation realignment actions at that time for the Department of the Army prior to there being a base realignment closure process. My business partner, Don Fix, who is a retired West Point graduate, Class 66, he and I worked those issues for the Secretary during that time frame. We both went to the private sector following that stage, and in 1989 formed our firm, Hijack and Fix, which is a small firm here in D.C. We have been involved in every base realignment and closure round since what's called the mini BRAC in 1988, which was actually done by the Department of Defense without there actually being a commission. And would like to believe that we've had a relatively positive and significant track record on behalf of those whom we served, and we provided information during the last testimony and in our response to the RFP with regards to those previous rounds. We also did, by the way, in 1995 represent the state of Alaska, so this is not our first time working with the state of Alaska in regards to military installations and a potential BRAC. In that case, of course, it was a real BRAC. This is, we're facing the potential of one in the future, along with force structure adjustments, which has been the subject of a lot of focus at Eielson Air Force Base and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The other area of concern that has to be out there for everybody is the Budget Control Act, which includes a mechanism known as sequestration that could likely kick in or could kick in effective January 2013 that would double the $487 billion in defense cuts already in place and firmed up as a result of the Budget Control Act. So it could go as high as $1.1 trillion if sequestration was fully implemented. So the point there is to make sure that we don't focus solely on BRAC, although that is clearly a potential area of concern. We have a near-term area that we focus on, which is how the budget is being implemented and being built and its impact on modernization of our installations. That has an impact with regards to the personnel reductions. We have the four structure adjustments that implement not only personnel reductions but potentially movements of missions and equipment. And then downstream, we have the potential of a base realignment closure or BRAC process, which has been requested by the Secretary of Defense. He requested authority, which Congress must give him before he can go forward. He requested authority to conduct two rounds, one in fiscal year 2013 and a second in fiscal year 2015. At this stage in time, legislatively, before I get into my presentation, so that you know, the BRAC has not been approved, nor will likely will not be approved by the Congress this year, and there certainly will not be a 2013 BRAC round. There is a reasonably strong potential that Congress may take up and favorably take action on approval for a BRAC round in calendar year 2013. The Secretary of Defense will push hard for a 2015 BRAC. There are those political pundits who believe it'll be 2017, and we'll just have to wait to see how that plays out. If I could make a point on the 2015 date, the reason why the Secretary will want a 2015 date is because it takes 5 years to execute a BRAC once you've gone through the process in order to achieve the savings that you wish to derive from the BRAC. If we wait for a 2017 BRAC, he doesn't see the bulk of those savings until 2022 and beyond. The Budget Control Act puts significant pressure on him to find this $487 billion in savings between now and 2021. Hence, a BRAC would really not do the Secretary of Defense much good if it doesn't occur until 2017. So, with that said, everybody is preparing for dealing with the budget cuts, the force structure adjustments, which will come downstream. There was an Air Force misstep this year in which they overreached and tried to do a number of things to include movement of the 18th Aggressor Squadron from Allison Air Force Base. And as you know, there is a strategic pause in place now as a result of legislation and the Secretary of Defense's commitment that he will not move forward with any of those aircraft or personnel movements while Congress is considering the fiscal year 13 defense budget. But there will eventually be some form of force structure adjustment in the Army and in the Air Force. And when we get done with all of DOD, the personnel reductions will total over 100,000 people. Again, BRAC, I've touched on briefly, so I won't go over that territory again. With that in mind, the state of Alaska wanted to begin looking at what steps could be taken to strike preemptively to prepare ourselves and protect ourselves as much as possible from any of those three factors, budget, force structure, or BRAC, and commissioned us to initially come in and do a review of the installations and to develop a strategic plan, which is the focus of my presentation today. And I am happy to go through my briefing, Mr. Chairman, which will cover where we stand and where we plan to go forward at this stage. But I'll stop in case there are any questions at this stage.
Okay, thank you. And let me just recognize we have Mayor Isaacson online from North Pole, and we also have with us representatives from Senator Murkowski's office, Greg Kaplan, and Senator Begich's office, C.W. Floyd. So questions from the committee? Okay, I don't see any. Any questions online?
None at the moment.
Okay. Please proceed, Mr. Hijack.
Yes, sir. What I'll do, because I'm not sure if everybody has a copy of the briefing outline, briefing that I prepared, but slide two of the briefing provides an outline of the topics I'm going to discuss, and that's to give you an update on where we stand regarding the strategic plan, what has been done to date, what we anticipate will be in the strategic plan as we go forward, and then other issues that are not the focus of the strategic plan but do color the recommendations and our near-term issues that need to be dealt with to include fiscal year 2013 legislative and budgetary actions. With that said, if I could move on to slide number 3, entitled State Military Installation Strategic Plan. Actions to date, our team, which includes folks from my firm and retired General Howie Chandler, who was the former ALCOM commander, former PACAF commander, and also former Vice Chief of Staff, we visited each of the major installations in the state of Alaska during the June timeframe. And the timing of our visit was somewhat unfortunate in that this was during the heat of the battle between the delegation and the state and the commander at that time of Pacific Air Forces as well as the United States Air Force regarding the 18th Aggressor Squadron proposed realignment to JBAIR. And with that said, the guidance that was provided to many of the installations was that there was a view that our visit could be linked to that issue, and so they were told to stick pretty much to a script of their mission brief to respond to direct questions only that were with information in the public domain, and then any other follow-on questions would need to be run back through the major command for disposition and potential response. We did, by the way, so that you know, and everybody, I should state, was very professional. There was no acrimony. These gentlemen were doing their job, and they were following their orders. But we had some good visits. We got some information that was very helpful to us. But the bulk of the information that has enabled us to make the progress we've made thus far has come from the Alaska Guard. We submitted to each of the installations a number of questions. In my slide, I noted the fact that there were 62 questions or data requests submitted to the active duty installations. And we received a letter in late July from PACAF indicating that any information that we might wish to have would be either in the SATAF report provided by the Air Force associated with the 18th Aggressor Squadron proposed movement, or would be subject to a Freedom of Information Act request. So there was nominal information that has come back from the installation. With the change of command in PACAF, we are going to make another run at securing this information because the environment has changed there. We have consciously made an effort not to raise this as an area of contention because there was a strained relationship at the time that we conducted the visit and submitted the request. General Carlisle has committed to a very open and very as friendly as possible relationship, and we certainly don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. So we are conducting some back-channel discussions with both PACAF as well as with the U.S. Army Alaska. General Garrett was brand new the week that we arrived. General Katkus has also been discussing information requests with the ALCOM command. So we have reason to believe that we may break through in the near future on receiving information, but it does impact the way we've approached the strategic plan, so that instead of doing a single plan, we are doing a phased plan. Phase one, focusing on the Guard, since we have information, and we are hoping to finish that relatively soon. And then phase two will be the omnibus state plan, which will include some details on the active duty installations. And it would be our objective to try to have that completed during the month of October. Having said that, we are not sitting on our hands waiting for information. As I've mentioned to you, we received very good cooperation from the Alaska Guard. But we've also reached out to other agencies to collect information and to conduct discussions on some potential initiatives to include the potential options for realignment of more advanced F-16s from either the Pacific or from Europe to one of the bases in Alaska. As you know, we have F-16, I believe they're Block 30s, and we'd be looking at potentially the Block 50, which is a very advanced fighter. We have also reached out to And that was, by the way, discussions that we had at the State Department on that issue, as well as with the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Pentagon. We've had conversations as well with the Air Staff and some other elements in the Pentagon regarding new mission opportunities with new airframes, everything from the Joint Strike Fighter and the KC-46 so-called future tanker, as well as the Air Force refers to them as RPAs, remotely piloted aircraft. The Army refers to them as unmanned aerial systems. The bottom line is it's an airframe that flies without a pilot, and we are looking at missions related to that area. And then the last thing that we've been engaging the Department of Defense, particularly Army and Air Force, in discussions on have been their personnel plans for fiscal year 14 and beyond as part of their reaction and adjustments to the force structure issues that came up this year. So as previously noted, and I'll go through this next little bit and I'll stop for questions, we're going to have a two-phase plan. It will be in a PowerPoint format, and phase one will focus on the reserve component, and phase two will focus on the active component, which of course are J-Bear and Eielson Air Force Base and Fort Wainwright. And I think I've discussed the estimated delivery timelines for that plan. If there's any questions on that slide, I'd be happy to stop for a moment.
Yes, we have a question from Colonel Jones.
Tim Jones here. I noticed there's a relatively small number of information requests to U.S. Army Alaska. What is that attributed to? Is that information that's more forthcoming?
The reason for the small number of requests was it was hard to tell what we needed to ask for, given that we got a command brief of roughly 10 to 12 slides. And so what we did was took the command brief along with some areas that we knew that we were going to secure information on that might lead to other questions, but we couldn't ask the subsequent questions until we had the first set of data, such as base operation support costs, any concerns with regards to encroachment issues, future military construction, and the future year's defense plan. So those are the kinds of things that we had asked of the installation, and pending receipt of that information, then that will allow us to do a follow-up request.
Okay, thank you.
Sir.
Any questions online? Okay, I don't hear any. Okay, please proceed, Mr. Hardjack.
Thank you, sir. On slide four, is there somebody asking a question?
Yes,
no.
Senator Thomas has a question.
Go ahead.
I'm not sure if it's a thank you and good morning.
Okay, is that Senator Thomas?
Yes, it is. Can you
hear
me okay?
Go ahead.
All right. Thank you for the hearing today, and I did want to comment, though, and I'm glad that Mr. Hijack feels better about what information may be coming in the future, because I, quite honestly, was very disappointed with what I thought was a disingenuous approach to releasing information, as well as a reluctance to release information that supposedly had been gathered or developed to justify the conclusions and actions that were intended for Eielson. And like I said, shortly thereafter, the action was changed as far as being delayed or put off for a period of time. But I just found it odd that when asked questions regarding costs, there was so little information developed other than the conclusion. That was what was given. So hopefully you're right that in the future there will be a better relationship on gathering that information. And I guess that's more of a statement of what I've seen in the past, and like you, hope for better in the future.
Yes, sir. No, and indeed we do. And again, we've had public as well as private statements made by General Carlisle, indicating that he does intend to have a more transparent, I shouldn't use the word more, a transparent relationship and a desire to work closely with the state and with the delegation. So, and also in fairness to him, he obviously has no control of the information coming from U.S. Army Alaska, and as I mentioned, General Garrett was brand new in the chair when we were up there. So with him having had more time in his command, we're hopeful that folks are going to be able to spend more time helping us help the state of Alaska and help their military installations put themselves in a strong posture for the future. future. And we did stress that this was, our visit was all about how the state of Alaska could help the installations put themselves in the best and the most optimal position for the future. So I'm encouraged, and we'll continue to hope for the best, and we'll be prepared to adjust accordingly if we need to. But we certainly do not want to have this become an issue of contention with the commands at this stage in time, and that's why we want to maintain a cooperative relationship with them.
Thank you.
Sir. On slide four, this is just to give you a sense so that you understand how we develop a strategic plan versus just, you know, it's our opinions. And so you'll see the major components on this slide, and that is the BRAC 2005 criteria will be the baseline against which all the installations are evaluated so that we have a common denominator. We will be utilizing information from each of the service teams as well as from the BRAC Commission and have used that already with regards to the work we've done thus far. We'll also take a look at all of the data that was prepared for the Grow the Force evaluation by the Army in 2008 of the Army installations, the information we're able to secure from them now as part of their force mix force design and their force structure adjustment planning for the future, and the limited amount of data, which was alluded to by the Senator, with regards to the force structure adjustments proposed by the Air Force. We also take into account the revision to the National Military Strategy. One of the points that I want to stress is that where we can leverage the Pacific focus or the Asia focus in the National Military Strategy to our benefit, clearly we want to do so. As, for example, providing a balance in the refueling capabilities from Hawaii versus from Alaska in terms of numbers of aircraft. So we'll want to use that to our advantage, but we also have to be cognizant of the fact that we don't want to hang our hat specifically on one iteration of the National Military Strategy that focuses on Asia. We need to be prepared to focus on capability and cost and power projection, particularly with Alaska as a strategic platform. The other thing that we will be looking at, and it's the issue of not looking at the installation as a single entity within just the fence line. There are things, when we say the fence line, the perimeter of the base itself. DOD is increasingly looking at areas of cooperation and contention with the local communities. Where can we share services? Where can we be helpful to each other? Where do we pose a problem to the community on things like noise? Where does the community pose challenges for us in areas such as encroachment? So we will be looking at that as well within our analysis. We will conduct a very top level, but a review of other installations of the capabilities that we have in Alaska and why we should have assets and advantages versus why they might, and make sure that we don't become myopic in looking at this as just an Alaska set of installations. So we want to make sure we do that. Also regionally, we want to see if there is potential cooperation. To give you an example, right now we have the 16th Combat Aviation Brigade, which is split between Fort Wainwright and Fort Lewis in Washington. Are there areas where there's collaboration? And if so, what are they? Additionally, as the Air Force looks at where it puts its future tanker, there's a high degree of likelihood that it could end up at Fairchild Air Force Base in Washington. Does it make sense, or is there a benefit to potentially some form of pre-positioning of some of the KC-46s on a TDY basis to Alaska? So we'll look at those. We're not going to make policy, but we want to make sure we think outside the box a little bit. Having completed an analysis, what we'll do is we'll provide a matrix that takes the installations against each of the eight criteria in the BRAC, and we'll do what the Pentagon refers to as a stoplight chart, red for poor, yellow for fair, green for good, blue for excellent. And we will score each of the installations against each of the eight criteria, which will then result in a concordant overall score for the installation in one of those color codes, and we'll provide that. We'll also provide recommendations in terms of either state or federal or a mix of the two actions to address each of those items that are not either good or excellent. So if they're fair or poor, how can we improve? What do we need to do? we're going to provide some recommendations for courses of action with regards to that. And again, one of the things that we'll look at, because the Department of Defense is in fact a significant contributor to the economic gross product of the state of Alaska, I think it's about 8% as an industry. We're going to try to look at this holistically in terms of what the state can do for the industry and what the industry can do for the state. And we'll get into things such as energy policy as an example of where collaborative efforts may benefit both parties. Sir, if you'd like, I could stop and see if there's any questions on that slide.
Thank you. I've got a couple questions for you. The first is, can you talk about some of the key criteria that were used in 2005?
Yes, sir. There are 8 criteria, and I'm trying to remember if I put those in the briefing for you. I think I did not. Bear with me 1 second so I can just pull something up and I can answer all of the questions. There are the top 4 criteria are what they're called the military value criteria, and they focus on items such as operational readiness, cost, manpower, and cost. Bear with me. Here we go. I'll pull it right up right now. So the top 4 criteria, number 1 is operational readiness and joint warfighting. Do you bring what's necessary to conduct military operations around the world, and how joint are you versus are you a stovepipe installation that only focuses on Army or Air Force or Navy? That's number 1. Number 2, diverse climate, terrain, and contribution to homeland defense. Clearly, we have no issues on diversity of climate and terrain in Alaska, but we'll also look at the homeland defense piece. 3 is the ability to support surge operations, and that comes back to if you have excess capacity on an installation and it costs money to support that excess capacity, that's a bad thing for DOD. On the other hand, Mr. Chairman, if I cannot bring on extra people, extra equipment, extra capability through your installation to support surge operations, that's a limiting factor. So there's a real balance that is struck there. And then the 4th criteria is one of the most important ones, and that is the installation manpower costs. And how do you rank against other installations of your size and type within the service? And have there been increased costs or spikes within the various cost factors that the department has to look at? The last 4 criteria are what DOD and the commission refer to as the tiebreakers. They are the cost of base realignment action. There is actually a model, computer model, called COBRA, cost of base realignment action, which takes all the cost to close versus the projected cost savings, and it generates what's called a net present value cost, and that determines how soon you get a payback on closing the installation. That fifth criteria, while it is on the bottom half, is probably the most important of the bottom half criteria. I've got 3 more to go through, and then I'll stop again here. Economic impact is probably to the communities the most important, but quite frankly, from DOD, one of the least important, and from the commission's perspective, they do pay attention to it, but it is again a tiebreaker in terms of their ability to adjust or to approve a recommendation from DOD. The last 2 are ability to absorb in a community, and that's when you're going to grow. Can you take on a new mission? Are there problems with housing? Are there problems with noise? Are there any environmental issues that we have to worry about? Those are the last 2 criteria that the BRAC will look at.
And are these criteria set forth in statute? Do we expect that the
criteria are in statute
that were used in 05 be used again in the next BRAC round?
Correct. Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The Secretary of Defense's proposal included the criteria, and it was word for word the same criteria as in 05.
And then do you have any timelines for when you would issue your recommendations?
Yes, sir. Our expectation is we would hope to have a draft plan for review by the governor's senior staff in October, mid to late October. Let them make sure that they have the opportunity to adjust accordingly, because there will be some internal state things that we feel we need to give them a good chance to look at first, and I would hope that we would have a document that we could provide to your committee in the late October, early November time frame. That will be for the entire state, which will identify all of the issues and propose courses of action.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Co-Chair Sadler.
Steve, we have individually and collectively raised the issue of the economic impact in Alaska as one that's of significant interest to the community in Fairbanks. Do we hurt our cause with DOD by raising that economic impact issue? Should we just be quiet about it, or is that a reasonable objection to voice?
No, it's a reasonable issue. They fully expect to hear about it. It's not that they don't care about it at all, but it is not a driver in their analysis to determine which bases to either expand, close, or realign. No community there. It's rare for a community not to want to keep their military installation. So they expect economic impact to be discussed, and I certainly would anticipate that it should continue to be an issue as it pertains to the 18th Aggressor Squadron. When it comes to the commission will want to see what the, you know, how significant the impact is, and particularly if it has any second, third order effects as it pertains to education in particular.
General Canellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve George Canellis. We haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet.
Sure.
Strategic location. Those of us that live and have served here like to believe that everybody understands Billy Mitchell's argument that we are the center of the universe. We can reach out and touch Europe and Asia quicker than anybody else. And you touched on that. Is that self-evident to the decision makers in this long process, or is this something we really need to articulate with some good maps, some good graphics, that sort of thing?
Sir, I would love to tell you that it is a significant driver in their decision-making. Let me start by answering this question two ways. The people who do the first cut in the analysis, particularly as it pertains to a BRAC process, let me focus BRAC right now, are number crunchers. They don't care about the strategic, well, I shouldn't say don't care. They're not focused on strategic importance, operational issues. They're worried about, is this base expensive to operate? Do they have high utility costs? Do they have a lot of MILCON? Is there a lot of military construction avoidance that I can incur as a result of closing them because they have $100 million of future MILCON I don't have to pay if I close the base down? They are green eye shade guys, and that's not to denigrate those people. That's what their job is. Later on, the sort of operational trade-offs, location, capabilities, those things will come into play. Would I like to tell you that everybody in the Department of Defense understands the strategic importance of Alaska? I'd love to tell you that. Do I think that's the case? Unfortunately, I don't. Certainly some senior leaders do, and they certainly will make those comments when they're visiting the state, and appropriately so. Unfortunately, we didn't get to meet. When I testified earlier this year, I talked a little bit about an experience, if you don't mind me droning on for about 40 seconds here, at another base. Luke Air Force Base is in Phoenix. We work with them. The perception in the Pentagon was Phoenix, fast-growing area, must be a lot of encroachment out there. We really can't put the Joint Strike Fighter there because we're going to have a real, real problem. And we literally, it took us about a two-and-a-half-year period of time to turn the aircraft carrier around in terms of perception to make the point that the state had done some really exciting things in terms of managed growth on how they manage land development. They still had growth, but it was properly managed so that it was compatible with the installation's current and future operations, to the point that when the Air Force did their analysis, they found out that only about 1,900 people total were potentially impacted by the Joint Strike Fighter coming in versus tens of thousands that would have been impacted at other locations. So it's a process, and it's going to be an educational process, and it is something that we definitely need to do, but it will not be a short-term victory. It's going to take us time, and it will be part of the plan that we propose to the state in terms of how we go about getting that message out, because it is important.
Follow-up, General Canellis.
Just very quickly, I'm somewhat familiar with the Luke situation and the people down there. They did a marvelous job. So if you were involved with that, kudos.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Okay. Yeah, I've worked on that for about four to five years, so thank you very much.
We have a question from Representative Sadler and then Representative Feige.
Thank you. Steve, you said that the first crack at the decisions are made by green eye shade people, number crunchers.
Sure.
I'd heard reports of some questions in the quality of the numbers regarding housing costs relative Anchorage and Fairbanks. Given your experience, what's your confidence in the quality of the numbers that are being crunched about Alaska bases?
Sir, let me also distinguish again between the 18th Aggressor Squadron force structure adjustment versus BRAC. Two different groups of people, two different processes. So I want to make sure I make that distinction. While there are clearly some legitimate criticisms and critiques with regards to how the data has been looked at thus far. It's a different group of folks that would be doing BRAC. Having said that, the reason we have a BRAC process and the reason that we have a BRAC commission is that there are all too often either flawed analysis, flawed or incomplete data, that when a community, if a community ends up on a list for a negative action, they'll bring in consultants, they'll bring in people who can run a COBRA analysis, they'll find those, they'll present that data to the commission, and if the commission finds that it the process was flawed, they have the option and will take action to adjust the recommendation. So, you know, it's in any process, garbage in, garbage out. If it's, but I would tell you that there is a great deal of oversight in the BRAC process, but it does not mean that it's flawless.
And I want to start asking you questions about how good a job Alaska does with its encroachment issues and so forth. I guess I should wait for the wait for a couple weeks for your report. So,
if I could impose on you to do so, I'd be grateful, sir.
Great, thanks.
All right, we have a question from Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Canellis touched on something there earlier, regarding Alaska being the center of the world, and you talked about something about the new. I think he called it the KC-46, which I believe is the 767
base tank.
Tanker that the Air Force is switching over to. What is the future life expectancy on the KC-135Rs that are currently based at Eielson? And you know, is from what you know of what's going on in the Air Force, Is there a real possibility that those tankers would move to Fairchild, which seems to me to be geographically somewhat out of position for filling their primary mission?
Let me make sure I didn't give you a false impression. There is a highly unlikely, and there is no discussion of any potential movement of tankers from Eielson to Fairchild. What I was trying to articulate is that if the KC-46 basing, when it goes forward, the odds-on favorites for the active duty installation is Fairchild Air Force Base. The odds-on favorite for the Air Guard facility is Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire. Both coastally based, provides capability to reach up the coast either east or west based on the two installations. Also, Boeing being in Washington State, Mr. Dix having been former chairman of Defense Appropriations Committee, Senator Murray on Appropriations, Mr. Smith on Armed Services Committee. The view is likely Washington State would get the KC-46, but that there's been no decision made. That is merely intuition from those involved in the process. And if they do end up getting the KC-46, they will have KC-135Rs that are there now that will need to go someplace, and they will have a home. The KC-135R is going to be around for a long time. Would the Air Force love to get rid of all the Rs and replace them with the KC-46? Absolutely, but budget constraints are not going to allow them to do that. They have retired the E-model fleet, which is the older version of the tankers, and those are all now at the boneyard at Davis-Monthan, but the R is going to be the backbone of the air refueling fleet for a number of years. I mentioned to you this first round of basing. I mean, we are literally talking about basing approximately between the three installations, the schoolhouse, the active duty operational base, and the guard base. We're talking roughly 60 aircraft for phase one. Phase two won't even be looked at, according to Air Force leadership, until 2020. So you can count on KC-135Rs being around for a long time.
Any questions online from committee
yes,
members?
This is Senator Pascan. Earlier, you indicated that there are F-16s in Asia and Europe that they're trying to get to one of the bases in Alaska. As far as the readiness criteria, is it a consideration that Eielson Air Force Base is not subject to the higher risks of earthquake or volcanic ash in the atmosphere?
Gotcha. Let me make sure that I'm clear, sir. If I gave the impression they are looking at that, I gave you a false impression. We, as the state's consultants, are looking at the opportunity for the potential of having aircraft currently based overseas to come to Alaska. There is no initiative either within the Department of Defense or the Air Force to do so. And the reason why we're looking at those two locations is because of the K capability of the aircraft that that are located in Europe and in Alaska. I'm sorry, in Japan. General Chandler, based on his many, many years of experience with the Air Force, felt that those would be the best potential airframes for us to look at. And so we're exploring that as an option. Just as we're exploring, and the Air Force is going to look at F-35 or Joint Strike Fighter basing in the future. So ILSIN clearly, you know, will be a focus. Looking at it from a state perspective, our objective is to first get them into the state, and we will obviously take into consideration and promote all the attributes that that you articulated potentially with specifically with regards to ILSIN Air Force Base. But just to go back and beat it to death, we're looking at opportunities where we can generate or initiate action that might bring something to us at this stage in time. There is no DOD initiative or plans underway for them to do anything either in the F-16 or the F-35 airframes at this point in time. We do hope, though, that we can get some potential positive movement on one of those two actions next year. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yes. Is the risks of that type of problem, the earthquakes or volcanic ash, is that considered in the worldwide BRAC process as a risk factor that is a criteria that is analyzed?
I would say that it is probably in the mix. How high a profile that would be, sir, I wouldn't want to hazard to guess. But is it a factor that they look at? Yes. And let me give you an example if I can. And this is, pardon me, it's apples and oranges. I know of an installation in BRAC 05 that was specifically looked at because of the potential threat for tornadoes and whether they would or would not do something at that installation. So environmental issues of that nature and their impact on operations are clearly looked at.
Any other questions online?
Question as well, if I may.
Okay.
Sure.
Go right ahead.
Just looking back again at my earlier statement regarding the response, and I think that was exactly right, that you said the first people to take a look at it are the bean counters. And I think that's what they've done to date. And that concerns me dramatically because I think long term that is a very short sighted, because if there were a conflict, I would think that the number one thing that we should be considering, which it looked like that was the number one thing as far as your list of eight, and that was the operational readiness, which seems to be based pretty much on the strategic location. So,
right.
And I realize you can't change people's minds, but I would think the our delegation should be hammering on that you know, the short-sightedness of looking at a base cost compared to which probably are dramatically different as we look around the world. But the idea that if something takes much longer and is much more expensive and is almost impractical to service a struggle someplace in the world, I would assume that cost would be much more, particularly in manpower and or to our economy long run, depending on how things are stretched out. I think that's actually why we have developed some of our defense systems, was exactly for that reason, was to shorten the conflict, to be able to react quickly and make sure that we shorten the time frame of any war that might come up. And I would think that particularly in the case of the Air Force, the closer you're located, the more strategic it is for you to get there. And the comment that was made earlier about what Billy Mitchell said, the idea of where we are in location, I believe, is extremely important, and that should outweigh the, and in the long run, if people took an analysis of, say, a 30-day war someplace, you could actually prove that situation up, that in the long run, you would by far, at the cost of airplanes these days and what could be destroyed sitting on the ground someplace or crashing because it's not able to even be refueled, just makes sense to me that would be the number one issue to push forward.
Sure. No, and sir, again, we certainly intend to push the strategic location as a critical issue. My responsibility is to try to give you as honest an opinion or impression I have of the way the process goes forward. And again, I think I should say before the number crunches get started, the first thing you do is they pull out the last list. If you were on the list the last time you survived, you're going to get a good hard look right off the bat. So we already know in the case of Alaska that ILSIN's going to get a look. It's just the reality of life, and that's true for every state, every installation that was on the last BRAC list. We'll start off with that. Then going back to how the virtue of my experience in each one of these BRAC processes, the next thing they do is they say, okay, we got that. Let's look at the cost factors and what else should be looked at that wasn't looked at last time because of major cost factors that have changed since we did our last BRAC round. Those are put together, and that's your initial list of how what you start to look at. At that stage in time, the operators, as part of these executive steering boards, they come into play, and they say, well, you might not like Camp Swampy because it's expensive, but it's the only place that I can do X, Y, or Z. I'll give you an example, if I may, and this is hopefully helpful and instructive. If you looked at it from a pure cost standpoint, the Army War College in Pennsylvania would not be in Pennsylvania. It'd be someplace else. But it has been the Army War College, and there are other things that happen in Carlisle beyond besides the War College. And because every senior Army leader has been through the War College at Carlisle, they're not going to move that installation. They're not going to move that mission. So that's one of those things where when we get into these executive steering boards at each of the service levels, those other sort of nuanced factors come into play, the operational factors come into play. When you get to the sort of last or most senior level of review, the sponsorship and the combatant commanders, the proverbial warfighter, their input becomes of great value because you'll understand and appreciate that when it gets to the four-star level, they've only got so much time to review this. And what they're going to want to know is, you know, what is the commander of ACC or CENTCOM or any of the other major commanders, what do they think about this? And if they really care and they have a concern or they're a real supporter, that's good for me to know. And if they don't care, then I probably have to go with the experts on my staff who put this recommendation in front of me. Does that help, sir?
That does help, and I appreciate the example because I look myself at a variety of bases in the southern states that would be completely useless and ineffective in any approach to generally the areas that I look at that we have concern that we may have conflict with in the near future or future
sure.
at all.
But you know, going back to your point, there is, let there be no questions. The strategic value and the location of Alaska is something that we will continue and has to be looked at as an issue, and its contribution to the warfighter's ability to cost effectively prosecute whatever their mission is. But it is going to take some time to work on that, and we're going to have a coordinated and a concentrated campaign in that regard.
I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we got a few questions backed up. General Canales has a question.
Thank you, Steve. The first criteria is the joint warfighting one. If Eielson goes down in a BRAC in a worst-case scenario, does that diminish the joint capability of Fairbanks, and then is Fort Wainwright in trouble?
Let me say I don't think that you would necessarily have a ripple effect to Fort Wainwright if that scenario were to develop, because when they'll do their senior review, they will look at they have these spider charts, and they will look at the concurrent impacts at other installations. And so Fort Wainwright is actually an attribute for Eielson Air Force Base. And so I guess what I would say is the Air Force will not be allowed to do something that will jeopardize the Army. And if anything, the Army presence at Wainwright does help Eielson Air Force Base. There's no universals, but I would want to stress that would be a plus, not a minus.
We've got a question from General Case.
Sir. Just very briefly, in addition to the strategic location, I haven't heard mentioned the training range utility, which is significant in terms of size of training and the track record of effective training.
Yes, sir. No, point taken. I have not discussed that as yet, and I appreciate you highlighting that, not to mention again, and this is another point, if I could, sir, and that's the unique environment of working in the Arctic. We know it's important. I sat down with the 168th, and I had them give me a point paper of what happens when somebody comes up TDY that's a tanker guy at Eielson that's never been in the Arctic, and all the things that they learned the hard way because they didn't know how to do it, didn't bring the right equipment, and so on and so forth. And it's amazing when you look at that. But the problem is we haven't fought a whole lot of wars lately in an Arctic environment. We've been in the desert or we've been in the jungle. And so, you know, the risk of not recognizing that importance to the potential of a future conflict is something that we also have to avoid. And so we're trying to not only push the strategic location, but also that unique training environment, not only size of the ranges and the capability of those ranges, but where they're located, because if we lose that skill set, what happens when we find ourselves in the position where we need it in the future? But I'm not going to lie to you, it's not a tough sell. It's a sell that has to outweigh the cost of, we like to do a lot of things in life, and I'm sure you recall this from your days in the military. There's a lot of things we'd like to do, and you've got the guy that says, as much as I want to do that, I can't afford to, so I've got to pick and choose where I'm going to focus my efforts. We can't afford to, and we have to work hard to make sure that there's not a trade-off of that training environment in Alaska versus a cost savings measure someplace else.
Other questions by committee members? Representative Sadler.
David, the question is, you've been through a number of these, both budget and BRAC and force restructuring, I guess. Is there any qualitative difference in the process in this round, go-round, or is it the combination of the force restructuring, the Budget Act, and the potential BRAC that's causing things to be different here? Is it the same playbook, or is there something new going on?
No, I think there is something new, and you have to take this as an opinion, so please let me issue that as a qualifier. The last BRAC was, as Department of Defense referred to it, as a transformational BRAC. A BRAC was originally envisioned as a cost savings ability to get rid of excess infrastructure, reduce your operational costs, and concurrent within that process to be able to realign your forces to be the most efficient from an operational and a cost perspective. That's what BRAC was supposed to be about. The last BRAC was, as they said, transformational, which was really nothing more than the Army used it as a vehicle to bring troops home from overseas and stay out of a food fight of which base was going to be the beneficiary. The Air Force used the last BRAC to realign assets that were in the Guard to move them to the active duty and to adjust the reserve component as they saw fit. And from a Navy Marine Corps perspective, it was to look at where I get rid of excess production or industrial capability that I just can't afford to keep anymore. That was what they did last time. This time around, Steve's opinion, and please take it as nothing more than that, the strategy by the Air Force was to use the force structure to do whatever they wanted to do in the Guard by virtue of manning, equipment, and location, do that in the force structure and focus in the BRAC on the active duty installations. Because in the end, the next BRAC is all about saving money. That's the difference between this one and the last one. Secretary of Defense Panetta's got a big bogey he's got to hit. And transforming is not what he's all about. He's all about cutting costs and still delivering capability. And the way you're going to get at that is by closing active duty installations. And clearly, if we look at the Air Force specifically, we're going to have fewer fighters. And so if you are not in a fifth-generation fighter, you're going to get looked at really hard, particularly if you are, for example, in a bomber and you're not a B-1, B-2 bomber, or if you've got an older F-16 block aircraft, they're going to get looked at more extensively because of the potential cost savings. In regards to the Army, until we see the actual force mix, force design come out, I can't say that we know this for sure, but the expectation has to be that heavy forces are going to take more hits than the light forces will. And so if you are someone that has got an armor division, you're going to have to be prepared to justify your existence in terms of, you know, the capability of the fight for the dollar expended. And I also think the Army's going to look at industrial operations just because they can't afford to continue to run as many depots and ammo plants and arsenals as they have thus far. So it is different, and it's different because they're going to use force structure to tee up what they want to go after in a future BRAC. And when I say they, not just the Air Force and what we've just gone through here, but all of the services, they are going to make sure, by virtue of how they budget for MILCON, within the budget constraints we have today, combined with whatever force structures, those will be leading signals to who they're going to take a look at the most when a BRAC comes around, in my opinion.
So the Pentagon is kind of using this as a three-phase, kind of as an opportunity to shake up a lot of things.
Yes, sir.
And to reorient the way they want to. So actually, is it fair to look at it as just three phases of one process?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement, because that's why I always try to make sure people don't just focus on BRAC, because obviously that's the thing that scares, that four-letter word that scares everybody. But it's the BRAC will be the culmination of these other processes feeding into it. So you,
I think we use BRAC as a shorthand for the whole budget, you know, realignment process. But you're,
yes, sir.
Yeah, other questions? Okay, let's move on to slide five.
Okay, sir. So that's basically slide five is just to talk to you with regards to while we're working the strategic plan, we're obviously also engaged with the delegation, the state, on issues that that exist between now and the future. And the slide is relatively self-explanatory, but just to touch on them, obviously the 18th Aggressor Squadron, SATAF, impacted our ability to get data. It is not the focus, the sole focus of our efforts, but it is clearly in the mix. It's part of the part of the range of issues that we have to address. And as you know, we currently have a strategic hold with regards to that and all other force structure adjustments, which I would remind people again that there were C-130s that would be impacted in at J-Bear with the 176 that were part of that package as well. Didn't get the attention, obviously, that the 18th Aggressor Squadron had, but they were in the mix too. So that's currently on hold. We have a change of command at PACAF, and we're working hard to robust the relationship with PACAF, and again, having worked with General Carlisle while he was at the Pentagon, and knowing that he was also in the legislative affairs shop, he understands how important good relationships are. Budgetarily, as I think you may know, but just in case you do not, once again, unfortunately, Congress is not going to get the 13 appropriations bills done by September 30th. And so as a result, the government will operate in a six-month continuing resolution, which will fund DOD, as an example, at the 2012 budget minus 10%. 5%. As a result of that, the defense appropriations bills will be kicked out into next year. Next year, we hope that Congress may take a look at the ability to go back and address issues with congressionally directed spending, which then potentially has an impact with regards to military construction projects in the state. Sequestration, I talked to earlier in this presentation, it effectively would kick in January of 2013 if nothing changes. We know both the Congress and the administration are very concerned about the potential occurring. They are looking for ways to negotiate an agreement, but no significant action will take place until a lame duck session in the November-December timeframe. And then in terms of 2013, what we're expecting is that there will be a BRAC authorized, and as I mentioned, many different opinions as whether it'll be 2015 or 2017. But I go back to putting yourself in Secretary Panetta's perspective. You want me to hold off on force structure adjustments. You want me to hold off on moving people. You want me to hold off on saving money. But you want me to hit a $487 billion cut. You can't do that unless you give me a BRAC authority, and he may, as a result of that, allow a greater pause on force structure adjustments and roll those into the BRAC process. The concern that we all have to have, and I say all, not just Alaskans, but anybody in the country with a military installation, is if a 15 BRAC is approved next year, we're already halfway through the fiscal year for whose data the Department of Defense will use to make their decisions. And so that's why, as we get our plan completed, we may urge for some quick action on some items that the state has control over, which could potentially create a beneficial impact for each of the installations. I can move on to slide six unless there are questions on slide five.
Just pause for 1 minute and let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You most of the focus has been or the concern has been on Eielson. Do you see other bases in Alaska potentially at risk?
Let me be careful about the word at risk. Are there other risks to installations for the potential of either negative realignments or some reduction in force? I think the answer is yes. Risk of a significant negative action, i.e., taking away a major unit component, closure, significant negative realignments. I think that we probably are in relatively good shape overall. I'm concerned about Wainwright's costs as well. One of the data points that I think I alluded to in our last presentation was the Army, what they call the TABS team, the Army Basing Study Group. In 2005, they ranked 97 Army installations against a set of criteria, one of which was cost to operate. Now, cost to operate doesn't mean the total cost to run the base. It's cost to operate against the capability provided. And Fort Wainwright ranked 97 out of 97. It's an expensive base to operate. They obviously didn't take negative action against Fort Wainwright in BRAC 05, but the fact that we came in last on a cost factor within the Army's internal studies, we have to make sure that we're prepared to address that. So right now I am, as I look at it, I've got a greater focus. I don't want to use the word concern. I've got a greater focus on the northern tier installations in the state, but not saying that everybody in the southern tier should relax and be happy, or that the northern tier should be worried and be scared. Those two installations, Wainwright and Eielson, have cost issues. Eielson clearly has a historical issue that they have to deal with from BRAC 05 and the force structure adjustment. I would also say, and again, this is not to try to give cause alarm to anybody on the committee, because I'm running through all the installations, but even at J-Bear, in 2005, as part of the transformation, joint basing was viewed as a great concept that was going to be the savior of the defense installation budget process. And across the board, joint basing has not delivered as many of the benefits as DOD thought that it would. So does that mean that joint basing could come to an end? I think joint basing will get a look at it, in the next round in terms of do we want to continue this process or not. So that was a long answer to a short question, sir, but I hope that gives you a general feel.
Thank you. And then can you just give us some kind of a sense about how many bases you think across the United States might be at risk, I guess, and maybe give some comparatives to what happened in 05 or in previous BRAC years, BRAC rounds?
It'd be hard for me to give you a hard number, sir. I mean, what I can tell you is that if you look at the last, let's look at 2005 BRAC, there were rough order of magnitude across DOD in the United States, so let's although the 50 states, there were roughly 80 to 100 proposed closures and roughly 200 to 250 realignment actions. I would think that, you know, we're at the point now when the next time comes around, there will be fewer realignments, and I think that there will be fewer closures, but the closures will be bigger because of the active duty installations versus, a geographically separated facility or a small storage facility, whatever the case may be. So I think you'll see fewer in the aggregate, but bigger numbers in terms of the impact when a closure occurs next time. If in terms of citing other installations that should be concerned, I mean, I'm loath to pick on other locations, but if I was, for an example, Ellsworth Air Force Base, which was on the list the last time, I would be concerned this time around. If I was Red River Army Depot in Texas, which was a proposed closure, and had a very powerful delegation and still does, but, there's only so many times you can fight that back, I would be concerned. So those are two examples, but I don't want to sit here and pick on those two as saying, well, those are the worst two and they face the greatest threat. But they stick out because, again, the Air Force cannot afford to continue to support the fighter bomber bases they have, and the Army cannot continue to afford to have the industrial operations they have when it can be done by the private sector. So thematically, that's why I picked those two.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Hey, Steve, my ears perked up when you talked about joint basing might get a tough look. Were you speaking of the possibility of unwinding current joint basing decisions, Lewis McCord, J-Bear, or just not doing it more in the future?
I think not doing it in the future is a clear possibility. Unwinding them, I think you have that it's going to have to take a look at how difficult that would be and whether they've actually achieved any efficiency versus X cost more money. If it has cost more money, I think they may take a look at it. But if it has simply just been much of the same, I don't think that they'll touch that. And I don't have the J-Bear numbers to be able to answer the question as to how much or less efficient J-Bear has been since they became a joint base.
The follow-up on kind of a peripheral thing, again, you've been doing this for quite a while, but I was going to ask you a question about how well Alaska is doing relative to other states. But before I ask that, are there any low-hanging fruit? Is there any real simple actions that Alaska could be taking now, or am I jumping to the conclusions you're going to have in your report?
Well, I want to be careful not to get ahead of the report, but I would say that an item that I can guarantee was going to be in our recommendation for you to consider, and I believe I referenced it in my testimony the last time, and that goes back to low-cost power for military installations. I don't know what the bogey, what the cost would be to the state to offer discounted power, and if it's not going to provide a significant savings, and when I mean significant, you know, anywhere between 8 to 10% or more, I'm not going to encourage us to just bite around the edges and expend the taxpayers' dollars. But I would certainly say discounted power as a short-term bridge will likely be a recommendation of something that I think the state should look at in the near term as an action. The bigger issue of the potential of adjusting the sources of energy from coal to natural gas and recognizing a lot of issues associated with that, that's a long-term issue that's way above my pay grade and far more complex than my simple mind can handle. But discounted power, it's something that's pretty easy, quick to do, easy to calculate, and then you have to do your cost benefit of whether it's worth it or not.
And I'll just say to committee members, we look forward to your conclusions in October, and I would anticipate another hearing probably sometime in November or December, so we could prior to going down to June also. The next group of legislators has at least some idea of what the recommendations are and where we need to be heading. Other questions online? Okay, I don't hear anyone. Yes, General Lessing.
I do have a question. You know, I speak to a lot of people in Washington and the military and whatnot, but I haven't heard too much about future BRACs. But from all your comments, Steve, today, that there's high assurance that in fiscal 13 there'll come an announcement for a BRAC. Could you give me a little comfort in that area?
Yeah, sir. I think that in calendar year 2013, when they're debating the fiscal year 14 budget, I want to be careful about all the calendar years and fiscal years. But you know, Secretary of Defense formally asked for authority for a 2013 BRAC. He's not getting that. That's done and over with. That's behind us. He had requested a second round for 2015. The likelihood is that next year after the elections, because Congress didn't want to authorize a BRAC this year due to the elections, the likelihood is that the Secretary of Defense will get his way and a BRAC round will be authorized as in calendar year 2013. The legislation will occur. The date of execution is still, you know, is still yet to be decided. Steve Hijack's opinion is it will be the 15 round that Secretary Panetta wanted it as his second round. There are those who think that it will be legislative to occur in 2017, so it's the next president's problem, not the current president's problem. I don't think that occurs because it doesn't do Secretary Panetta any good, because that 2017 BRAC doesn't give him the savings he needs to have to pay his bills. So my opinion is there will be congressional approval in calendar year 2013 for a fiscal year 2015 BRAC.
As far as Wainwright is, or rather Alston is concerned, I know we got a pass.
Temporary.
Temporary pass on that thing to fiscal 13, if I remember right. Do we have any new intelligence or any new news regarding Alston?
Well, the community up there has a weekly Tiger Team call that we participate in. The Air Force, and this was discussed, by the way, so this could change, but the Air Force has, first of all, let me step back. All of the proposed force structure adjustments are on strategic pause until the legislation for the FY13 budget is done, the appropriations bill and the authorization bill, because both of them have provisions that would preclude that from happening for the balance of fiscal year 13. So the Secretary of Defense has said, until I get your legislation, I'm putting everything on hold. And then if your legislation continues to affirm that it can happen in 13, I, of course, will honor and respect that. So for FY13, we all believe that the issue is off the table for actual execution. Having said that, the Air Force is doing its due diligence and preparatory work in the event that they can execute in FY14. So, again, if I could, let me go back to Luke Air Force Base. Luke Air Force Base had a force structure adjustment that would have moved two squadrons out of Luke Air Force Base to Holloman. That is currently on hold. However, the Air Force continues to build the buildings at Holloman Air Force Base and do the planning and manning operations that are required and environmental documentation that's required in the event that they can move those aircraft in 2014, because you clearly can't do it overnight. Equally, as it pertains to Eielson, it is our understanding that the Air Force continues to do the environmental preparatory documentation and reviews that are necessary, but they are not spending any money with regards to facilities, personnel, or anything that would raise the ire of the delegation and the state as it pertains to that proposed force structure adjustment. But they're doing the paperwork, administrative things that from their responsibility is their fiduciary responsibility to get done in the event that future authorization is given to them.
So really there's high assurance that in fiscal 14 the 16 squadron out of Eielson will be moving to...
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that at all, sir. What I would say is that if they get approval in 14 to do it, they're going to have their ducks in a row to be able to move forward, but there is currently nothing that should give them cause to believe that they're going to be any more successful in fiscal 14 than they were in fiscal 13 at this stage in time.
Back to the question I had during our first session.
Sir.
What happens to the guard wing that resides up at Eielson when you move the Air Force squadron out of there, plus all of its support tail apparently will come out of there?
If the 18th Aggressor Squadron were, and we're in conjecture here now, so be careful about that. But if the 18th were to leave, it is clearly not helpful for the long term viability of the 168. And the 168th has acknowledged that, and they're doing all their appropriate planning should something like that occur. But there is nothing at this stage in time, to be very clear, that allows the Air Force to do so. But yes, there's clearly a question of dominoes. If something happens, there's a current second, third order effect. But at this stage in time, everything is on hold as it pertains to that movement.
We have General Kakis. Did you want to weigh in on this, General?
I certainly weigh in on an opinion that we plan for everything. What the considerations would be, the mission is still there. We still have a viable requirement to be up there. So Guard Bureau, in cooperation with DOD, would be looking at different areas like Fairbanks International Airport, as we've got in other states across the United States, as far as co-locating a wing on a commercial airfield, if need be. Or they'd look at, first of all, is there any component of Eielson that could remain in order to support it? But clearly, they did not have all the information when they came and identified that it was an 8-to-5 job. We have a 24-hour-a-day mission, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year. That wasn't part of the calculation, so they are having to deal with that. Other areas that we're looking at is an association. How can we make the 168th even more relevant? And the relevancy there is how much fuel do they push? They don't push near what the requirements are. So there is quite the cottage industry for fueling up there. So we're a very viable unit. It's just a matter of if they close the base, they're still going to have to identify where we're going to be located.
Questions online? Okay, let's move on to the next slide.
I think that, sirs, I think that does conclude my briefing. Sorry. I apologize. There's the conclusion slide. I think the... going back to the plan, I want to make sure that I stress that we are not just this is not a reactive, hold our own kind of a plan that we're going to propose. we have to recognize that a BRAC, if a BRAC occurs, or even these force structure adjustments, we're shrinking DOD. We're not expanding DOD. But there is going to be some areas that there will be room for movement, and we want to try to be as proactive as we can to seek new mission opportunities that are out there. And then, as the chairman noted, as we get this plan completed, we are going to identify some near-term and then some longer-term issues for action, for consideration by the state and by the legislature. We really have good cause for optimism, in our opinion, with General Carlisle down at PACAF, that we're going to see some positive movement and improved relations. And we also hope a more open line of communication with the command. But we know he is very sensitive to the issues in the state of Alaska. And the bottom line is, as we've discussed before, and I think one of the members mentioned this, BRAC is part of a three-element process, which has some very, very near-term issues pending, i.e. the 18th Aggressor Squadron, some very short-term issues pending as it pertains to the release of the 14 budget and the potential of something downstream as early as 2015 from a BRAC. And that, sir, concludes my briefing, and it was, I think I took much more of your time than I probably should have.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. No, good briefing, Steve. Thank you. In terms of the future missions, I'm sure we'd all like to get new tankers. We'd like to get the new Joint Strike Fighter. The UAVs or the drones seem to be the most cost-effective, low-cost equipment to deploy. Is that something that other states are also looking at, or is the UAV mission up for grabs?
Sir, I would tell you that, as a matter of fact, when I had this conversation with General Lyon down at Air Combat Command about 2 weeks ago, RPAs and cyber are the flavor of the day. If you can spell RPA or cyber, you're a state, you want that mission. So I think the thing that we want to try to be careful about is making sure that we're selective on a segment of the RPA or the cyber area where there's a need, and where we have a better chance to benefit than other states would. A lot of states would love to have an RPA mission where they're actually flying the hardware around. But we can't fly it out in the national airspace because FAA won't allow it because of the sensitive void issue. So it can only be flown in restricted airspace. Current RPA technology does not have any de-icing capability. So from an airframe perspective in the state of Alaska, that's a limiting factor for us. But as certainly the TAG knows, the Air Force looks very heavily towards the Air Guard as an example, for what they call reach-back capability, where we can fly airframes that are in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the world from the U.S. We can track targets and gather intelligence and execute against targets through various types of missions that the Air Guard can perform. And those are an area that I think we want to make sure that we focus in on. Just as in the cyber area, what we want to make sure if we look in the cyber area is that we're filling a niche where there's growth capability. And so that leads you more towards the information aggressor squadrons than it does in terms of, for example, running a network operations center. So we have to be very careful as we look at those writ large areas of cyber and RPA to find a small space that suits us well. But they are clearly growth areas. They're not the only place that we think there will be growth potentially for the state, but it's an area that we'll definitely focus in on.
General Case had referenced the training capabilities in Joint Alaska-Pacific Range Complex. Would it be beneficial for Alaska's suit if we were to make any additional commitments to the Northern Rail Extension to improve the access to the J-Park?
At this stage, sir, if I can defer on that one, because I don't have a good answer for you, is the honest answer. I really need to take a look at that issue in greater detail than I have thus far.
I'm really looking forward to your report, if you can tell.
Yes, sir. I will make sure that that's something I address for sure.
Representative Peterson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on a totally different subject, I actually read recently that there are some that are advocating for improving our missile defense systems, making them more accurate, and improving the technology And have you heard anything about that? Would there actually be increased funding and spending in Alaska to upgrade Fort Greely?
My impression with regards to Fort Greely is that it is one of the proverbial pointy tips of the spear from a missile defense capability perspective, and that there is additional investment that the Army continues to plan to make there, both in terms of infrastructure and capability. We also received some information last week that there is likely also going to be an expansion of the missile interceptor tracking and defeat capability in the lower 48, particularly as we find more and more challenges to a missile defense network in Europe. But in terms of Greeley, I think that Greeley has certainly got the attention of, and there is continued investment plan for Fort Greeley in terms of its capability and its infrastructure.
Thank you.
Sir.
Any final questions online? Okay, I don't hear any. Back here, we have Representative Sadler has a question.
And Steve, there's a question I asked earlier. I'm going to raise it again. I know you got your fingers in a lot of the activities going on around the nation. How is Alaska's effort stacking up with what other states are obviously fighting to preserve their missions and manpower investment? How's Alaska doing?
Alaska's doing just fine. Everybody is still in the early days. Those who are actively engaged right now are doing what you're doing. They're developing a plan. They're looking at their alternatives. You certainly have demonstrated a clear and credible deterrent to the United States Air Force as a result of the way the state and the delegation and the community came together with regards to the 18th Aggressor Squadron issue. So let me say that says a lot to them in terms of non-BRAC actions. The other side of the coin is, I would say, when it comes to BRAC, they're insulated somewhat from the politics of you know, how we work these issues with regards to the 18th. In terms of the ability of the state to CAD-PACAF, Air Mobility Command, and the major commands on side, I think we're equal or ahead of other installations in other states in the country. So, you know, right now, I would give us a good solid B on the report card. Are we the A++ gold star? Not yet, but that's a lick on me because we're still trying to pull this plan together for you. But are we down in this, you know, the C average level? No, I think we're certainly ahead of many others in the equation. And some states are just, you know, have buried their head in the sand waiting, you know, to see when it happens. And once the BRAC happens, well, then we're going to do something. And history shows that those locations don't do well.
And follow up, who is the gold standard? Who's getting the A+?
Well, sir, that would mean I'd have to know what every state is doing. But I, I don't have a good answer for you. That's two I don't have a good answer for you on, I'm afraid. I guess I would have to take a look at, and this will make it sound like I have a bias, but I would have to look at Kansas as an example because they kept their governor's military council intact and in place going back to 2003. They never let it go away after BRAC. They still have a full-time paid executive director. You know, they have frankly suffered some setbacks politically because their members don't sit on defense committees, but they have continued to come to Washington twice a year with the senior level delegation led by the lieutenant governor to meet with DOD officials. So if I'm going to give them an A++ gold star, it's because of the fact that they just never let their guard down. But in terms of have they done anything so discriminatingly better than you in the last 6 months, no, I can't say that they have. It's just the fact that it's been sustained. And by the way, they were the sixth largest gainer. I'm sorry, they were the sixth largest gainer in BRAC 05. So they know they have to be proactive because, you know, when you make yourself a target, people will shoot at you, and they know that.
All right, other questions? General Kakis, any final words on your part?
Yes, sir, I do. I kept my comments short because I wanted Steve to get as much time as possible, and clearly his education, his experience provides an unlimited opportunity for questions. I find him to be an extremely capable individual and well thought out. A couple different areas I'd like to hit on just real really fast, and that is the unfortunate timing that he spoke of initially. The aggressor squadron move kind of set the stage for a confrontation or a confrontational environment that really we're looking at a much larger pattern, and our meetings with the senior leadership have demonstrated that they realize that we're looking at all of Alaska and how to make Alaska a better place for the military to operate. I think that is coming across very clearly. Colonel Jones, your comment on the information getting from USARAC next, or this Tuesday, I meet tomorrow with Major General Garrett, and at that point we'll start to converse and probably generate more questions. Last week I met with Lieutenant General Hogue, and we've identified a way ahead in trying to get that information over to Steve, because clearly he's working hard on phase one, which is the reserve portion of the plan, but he needs some information in order to move forward. So I think clearly General Carlisle has established the fact that he wants to have a good working relationship with Alaska, and General Hogue and General Garrett are certainly both in that position to make that happen. And again, I wanted to clarify with all of the different contacts that Steve has, he really doesn't have insider information. What he does is he has a crystal ball where he can kind of say, if this happens, what can I do to make my my client in the best position, and in this case being Alaska. So a lot of his suggestions are, if there's a movement afoot to do anything, we want to be in the best position, and he can help predict and advise us in that area. So that's where his report will be kind of focused. In the area of the National Guard, certainly cyber and RPAs. Those are the buzzwords of the day. However, Alaska has something else going for it which the other states don't have necessarily, and that is space and the Arctic. So in space, Representative Peterson, in open source reporting where they're looking at missile defense, the battle space that Alaska protects is mid-course. That's exactly the best. That's the sweet spot for defense. During the boost phase, that's where you get your big cost savings. It's only a 20-second fight, and there's a lot of money that needs to go into that and the terminal phase. So right now, Alaska, we operate in the mid-course range. That's the perfect spot there to be working in. And again, NORTHCOM has identified that the reconnaissance and surveillance deficit is certainly there when it comes to the Arctic. And most importantly, we've partnered significantly with the U.S. Coast Guard. And Steve is also, even though it's not a DOD asset, it is part of the equation, and Steve's folks are working real hard to make sure that we position ourselves in synchronization with the U.S. Coast Guard. But clearly, the Arctic is going to be an area for military growth, DOD growth, and the Coast Guard growth in Alaska. So, Mr. Chairman, any questions for me?
Questions for General Kakis? General Canales.
Tom, the 176 wing, it's the biggest, most complex wing in the Air Guard. It's got strategic airlift, tactical airlift, rescue. If I'm a green eyeshade type, I could cut one of those missions and save the flag. Is that on your agenda? Are you thinking about that?
As far as save the flag, cut one of the missions?
In other words, you could lose one of those missions but keep the wing. If I'm cutting cost.
Yes, sir, that could be part of the equation. Almost every one of those missions is tied to an active duty fight at the moment. So whether it's the ACS, that helps control the intercepts with any type of a threat nation coming into our airspace. The refueling refuels those fighters that go out. The rescue supports any type of mishap. The strategic lift of the C-17 and the association. So when you look across the 176, every one of the missions, except the 144th, the airlift, but there's so few 130s that are out there, were critical to PACAF. So we probably need to make sure that that association with the 130 remains, and that would be the kind of the protection that we can provide. Every mission will be protected in some way, shape, or form, being in line with an active duty requirement.
Okay, thank you.
Final questions. Any questions online?
Question.
Yes.
It's been mentioned.
Who's that speaking? Is there a question online?
Yes.
Okay, who's that speaking?
This is Chick Wallace in Fairbanks.
Okay, Chick, go right ahead.
I'm not too familiar with this operation, so forgive me. Question, that the power, the cost of power has been mentioned. Is there any cost relationship between the natural gas and coal, because the Allison uses coal, as does Fort Wainwright, then that coal is a fairly cheap source of generating power. Both those plants are cogeneration plants, which means they generate, they produce the heat as well as the electricity. My question is, if it's a matter of having cheaper power, are you, as the consultant, suggesting that perhaps the state should look big check and build a gas line?
Mr. Chairman, no, sir, I'm not going to suggest that the state should write a big check to build a gas line, but I think that the state should take a look at the total net cost of what the current coal-fired operations result in, both for the state of Alaska as well as for the Department of Defense, environmental compliance issues, improvements to the baghouse, improvements to the boilers, low-cost power payments, I believe, that are made to Alaskans in the civilian community, to look at that, and then to look at the significant investment that would be required for natural gas and whether some of those other costs then go away as a result of natural gas. I don't pretend to know the answer. I'm simply suggesting that it's something that probably needs to be looked at. Does that make sense?
Chairman McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner, DMBA, as you're part of that Interior Energy Task Force that met last week, and AEA is working very closely with you and other members of the legislature, we plan on providing information to them to be part of the greater energy solution. So as Mr. Wallace pointed out, we're not advocating for one specific solution, but we'd like to make sure that everyone is aware that DOD is affected just as much as maybe the private homeowner in the area.
Thank you. Final questions? Okay, I want to thank everyone again. Mr. Hijack, thank you for your excellent presentation. General Kakis, thank you again. And we have really just an incredible group of resources here that's available to us with generals and colonels who've served our state and our country. And I want to thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedule to come here and be a part of this important issue. And with that, we are adjourned. It's 11:35.